Well, I bet you've never had a sermon where The Price is Right was in the title, so hopefully that at least piqued your interest. We're going to start today by playing some games. So you need to focus. You need to assume, first of all, that you actually want to win the game. If you don't care, it's not going to work. So let's pretend everything you value is hanging in the balance and you really want to try to maximize your chance to win. First one's going to go real fast, so I'm just going to ask you to do something, give it a moment's thought, think of the answer, and then we'll come back to it. You're playing against one other person. It's a very simple game. You're both going to pick a number from 1 to 10. Whoever gets closest to that number wins. It doesn't matter if you go over or under, it's just whoever is closest to the number wins. Pick a number. Okay, time's up. And you get to go first, by the way, so the other person will pick after you. I should add that. So if that, we'll do it again. You're picking first, then they're going to pick. What number do you pick to maximize your chance to win? 1 through 10. Now, there are two correct answers to this, and the rest are wrong. The correct answers are 5 or 6. I'm not going to ask you to show your hands. If you picked anything else, you don't understand probability. And here's what I'm going to explain to you, probability. You're trying to get closer to the number than somebody else. So if you said 2, then the other person, presumably understanding probability, would pick 3. And so any number from 3 to 10, they win. You win on a 2 or a 1. So obviously they're going to do much better if they do that correctly. Since you know the other person's going after you, you need to be right in the middle of that line from 1 to 10, and that would be 5 or 6. And if they're smart, they'll pick the other one. If they're not, they don't understand probability. I'm not saying they're not smart. I'm saying they don't understand probability. And a lot of people don't. And I'm going to demonstrate that brief in a short period of time. You can go on TV and watch people who don't understand probability all the time on the game show The Price is Right. But the thing is, if you're trying to win this particular game, you have to use logic. You have to understand what it means to be closer to a number than somebody else. You have to sort of visualize this in your head, a line with the numbers 1 through 10 on it. And you want your little marker, the number you pick, to be closer to the correct answer than the other person. And some people just don't understand this for whatever reason. But this flaw in logic has other implications, so I'm going to get to that in a little bit. But the underlying point of this talk today is logic has a role in our spiritual lives, in our religious thinking, in our philosophical outlook. I'm going to try to demonstrate that. We're going to play another game. This time, two players, again. Someone's going to randomly generate a number from 1 to 10. And this time you get to go second. So the first player picks 3. What do you pick to maximize your chances of winning? And it's 4. Okay, that one's easy. I explained the timeline. I explained how to visualize this. If the first person picks 3, you pick 4 and you win on 4 through 10. So that's more numbers are they're going to win on, which would be 1, 2, or 3. So you win on 7 of them, they win on 3. You've maximized your chance. Now that doesn't mean you're going to win, because the random number generator might come up with 1, 2, or 3. You're just doing your best. Now it's going to get harder. Now we're going to add a third player. You're still got the timeline from 1 to 10. Someone's going to generate a random number. And then the first player picks the number 3. And you're going to have to think about this. So 3's been picked. The second picks number 6. What do you pick to maximize your chances? First player picks 3. Second one picks 6. What do you choose? And the correct answer is seven, because you went on 7, 8, 9, and 10. That's four. The other two players are, you know, the one who picked three gets 1, 2, or 3. The person who picked six, they're the really in a tough situation, because they win if it's a six, and they win if it's a five. But if it's a four, the person who picked three wins. And you could go on and on like this. I'm going to give you one more, and then we're going to be done with this part of it. This time, you have to pick first. And there's going to be two more players after you. And you need to set yourself up in some way to at least have a few chances to win. It always stinks to go first. But what number could you pick, thinking that the other two are also trying to win? What number probably gives you the best chance? And this is the hardest one by far. So, let's start with, well, you go with the middle number, you know, because that's what you did with two players. So you pick a five. Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen right away. They're going to pick four and six, and you're going to be stuck right there at five. Probably your best chance would be a three or an eight, because odds are none of them are going to, if you choose three, no one's going to choose two, because that just gives them two chances to win, two or one. So they're probably going to go on the other side of that timeline. And conversely, if you choose eight, probably no one's going to choose nine or ten. Equally unlikely is that anyone going second would choose a number right next to your number, because then the third player can just cut them off. So if you choose three and they choose four, last player chooses five, that person who chose four is really stuck. And the person who went last maximized their chances. Okay, now what in the world does all this have to do with what I'm going to be talking about today? Well, we're going to use The Price is Right as an example. That game show that's been on forever. When I was young, and I don't know if I'm remembering correctly, but you always have this initial little game where you have people sitting up front and they show some object and they say, try to guess the price, and they all guess. And in this particular version of the game, if you guess above the price, you're out. So you have to be below the actual price. And I seem to remember it was only three people guessing way back when I was young, but nowadays it's four. Maybe it's always been four and I don't remember correctly. So last night I went back online and watched this again, just to make sure the same thing's happening today that used to happen when I was young, because it used to drive me crazy. So let me give you an example, and this is one that I actually saw on TV, or at least on the internet from TV. They had this object, I don't even remember what it was, but people guessed prices like this. $250, $500, $1,000. So the last person has this great opportunity. All they got to do is say, do I think it's over $1,000? Because if I do, the highest bid so far is $1,000. I should bid $1,001, because that way the person who bid $1,000, they have one shot, and I get everything that's above that. Conversely, if I think it falls between $500 and $1,000, that $1,000 is too high, I should bet $501. Because then the person who bet $500 is pretty much shut out unless they get it dead on. And I win everything from $501 all the way up to $999. So everyone following that, if the price is in that range, I win. And I shut out the $1,000 person. So this last player, who was really a very poor player because he's constantly doing this, $250, $500, $1,000, and he goes $600. Now he just gave $501 to $599 to the person who bid $500. He just gave them all those guesses right there, gave them away. And he's not doing it out of the goodness of his heart, and he's not doing it because there's this rule that says you can't bet a number one value higher than somebody else, because there were players who knew how to play the game. And someone would bet $600 and they'd go $601. So obviously it's legal, and some people knew what they were doing. But this poor guy, he didn't understand the way the game was played. He couldn't visualize maximizing his chances. Now the question became, and by the way, this happens throughout the history of The Price is Right. Because this used to happen when I was a kid. You know, I'm 12 years old and I'm looking at the TV going, why are they doing that? Don't they understand? And they didn't. Why is that? Why is it that people don't grasp this opportunity to maximize their chance to win a game they want to win? And there's some possibilities. Why don't people think logically? Well, maybe the pressure of being on TV is too much for them, and they just, you know, people are yelling prices out and they just don't think. That's certainly possible and probably true in some of the cases. Maybe instead of using logic, they just want to go with their gut instinct. I think I know the price. I really think I know it, and I'm just going to call it out because I think I know it, and they're going with their gut, not with their head. Lots of people do that. How about they just want to do something that feels right? Sort of the same thing as going with your gut, but you're trying to use intuition, you're trying to pick up a mental vibe or something and nail that number. You don't need to nail the number to win the game. You just need to maximize your chance by how you place your bet. Or maybe they're succumbing to peer pressure because someone they trust, maybe their spouse, is behind them yelling out a price, and they say, I better go with what my spouse is yelling at me, because if I screw up, I'm never going to hear the end of it, so at least it won't be my fault. And so that's passing the buck, not taking responsibility. People do that a lot, don't they? So these and other problems arise when people also think about religious truth, ultimate truth, spiritual matters. There is equally sloppy and illogical thinking in that realm. It's not quite the same as trying to guess a number, but people will do things that are obviously flawed from a logical perspective. And I'm going to go over a few of those with you today to encourage you that whatever path you're on, you are using logic and reason as part of your evaluation of your path. Because any path worth being on will hold up under that evaluation, I believe at least. After this, you may say, no, Doug, you're wrong. I can't argue the point, but I think if it's worth following, it's worth evaluating. So the first one, and I have touched on this in the past, is something called Pascal's wager. Blaise Pascal was a mathematician, but he was also a bit of a philosopher and theologian. And he would argue, in short, that you need to gamble on Christianity being true. You need to live your life as though it's true. Even if you don't know it's true, the payoff is much better if it is true, and the resulting loss will be horrible, eternal damnation, if you're wrong and bet against it. And his logic used some of the, and these are lines from his writing, translated. So number one, using his logic, God is or God is not. Reason cannot decide between these two alternatives. Either there's a God or there isn't, and you cannot reason it out. Point one. Point two, a game is being played. Heads or tails will turn up. In other words, there's going to be one of two binary choices here. Either there is a God or there isn't a God. Number three, you have to wager on this coin flip because you're alive and you're going to die and you're going to find out if there's a God or not. So your whole life is essentially calling heads or tails on this cosmic flip of the coin. Number four, let us weigh the gain and loss, wagering that God is. Let us estimate these two chances. If you gain, you gain all. That is, if you bet that there is a God. If you win, you gain all. You gain heaven, eternal life. And if you lose nothing. So if you spend your whole life believing that the Christian God is the real God, and it turns out you're wrong, no problem. You haven't lost anything. Point five. Wager then without hesitation that he is. In other words, you must bet without hesitation on the proposition that the Christian God is real and live your life that way. There is an infinity of an infinitely happy life to gain and a chance of gain against a finite number of chances of loss. And what you stake is finite. And so our proposition is of infinite force. When there is the finite to stake in a game, where there are equal risks of gain and loss, and the infinite to gain. In other words, the stakes of this game are infinite. Eternal life, perfect happiness. You must stake your finite life on this bet that the Christian God is true, that the eternal awards await, and so that's the bet to take. You don't bet against that. And finally, number six, but some cannot believe. They should then at least learn your inability to believe and endeavor then to convince themselves. In other words, he actually argues in his writings that you can practice believing until it becomes real. That you live as though you are a Christian, you live as though you believe these things, and if you do it long enough and repetitively enough, it will become real. You will gain faith through the sheer brute force of doing it day by day by day. So that's Pascal's wager, and it's an elaborate argument. I'm just giving you the highlights. But the question is, what's the logical flaw with all this? Or logical flaws? Because he's laid it all out as though this is it. Well, we are going to turn to another great philosopher to see what the problem is. That famous man of wisdom, Homer Simpson. Because there is at least a meme going around out there. I don't know which show he said it in or if he did, but he said, suppose we've chosen the wrong God. Every time we go to church, we're just making them madder and madder. That's absolutely true. The first flaw with Pascal's wager is there's only one type of God, it's the Christian God, and we're not even taking into consideration all the other possibilities. Not only that, the other flaw is we're assuming we understand what the eternal rewards really are. We're taking at face value one religion's perspective and then betting our life on that without consideration of all the other religions there are and religions that may become at some point in the future, all the possibilities of God being something beyond our understanding. And so he boils it down to this binary choice, a coin flip, when in reality, it's just not that simple. But believe me, because I know I've lived this, this is presented as a reasonable reason to be a Christian. It was presented to me this way when I was thinking of leaving the faith, and I started talking to pastors and Sunday school teachers, and one even gave me Blaise Pascal's book to read on this very topic, arguing that this is why it makes sense to stay a Christian, Doug. And it just doesn't, because life isn't that simple binary choice. And Homer Simpson's words are absolutely accurate. You may bet on the Christian God, but whoops, what if the Christian God isn't? What if it's Thor? You know, Thor's not going to be real pleased that you're following the Christian religion. And who knows what awaits you if Thor's the real God? And being silly on that one, but, you know, let's look at some of the major religions. Islam, depending on who you talk to, has a pretty dim view of what happens to Christians. In some perspectives, maybe you can still squeak your way into heaven, but not nearly on the same level that true believers are. In others, you're going to be in hell too. So, Homer Simpson's right. That is the problem with Pascal's wager. Here's another one. This is something that C.S. Lewis proposed, the famous author, especially of The Lion, The Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Narnia Chronicles, but he also wrote a few Christian books. I would not call him a heavyweight theologian by any means, but he was sort of an apologist. He tried to argue for why Christianity was true. And he has what's called the liar, lord, or lunatic argument. And I'm going to quote from his book, Mere Christianity, right now. And what he's doing is, right now, in this book, he is attacking liberal Christians. He's not attacking atheists or people from other faiths. He's calling out other Christians who don't believe that Christ is God, that don't believe in the Trinity. So this is what he says to them. I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. That's Jesus. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. You know, that's what the liberal Christians believe. And he's saying this is wrong. That is one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would be either a lunatic on the level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Now it seems to me obvious that he was neither a lunatic nor a fiend, and consequently, however strange or terrifying or unlikely it may seem, I have to accept the view that he was and is God. So that's from Mere Christianity. And this argument is used all the time as a form of apologetics. Apologetics is arguing in defense of something, in this case, Christianity. And this liar, lord, or lunatic argument is very popular. But the question is, what is the logical flaw with this? First of all, he argues that you only have three choices. He's a liar, he is Lord, or he's just a lunatic, a deluded fool who claimed to be God but didn't. Well, we don't actually just have three choices here, and this is where the logic falls apart. First of all, C.S. Lewis is making the assumption that, one, Jesus did exist, and while many people will argue he existed, even if they don't believe anything he said or don't believe he was God, even atheists and agnostics to a large degree acknowledge that Jesus existed, there is a school of thought, and it's not just sheer spite, that argue that Jesus was really a mythological creation of the early Christians and not an actual historical figure. Now, merits of that aside, that is one possibility C.S. Lewis doesn't acknowledge. The second one is, he has assumed that everything in the Bible attributed to Jesus are the words that actually came out of Jesus' mouth. We do not know this to be true. That's an assumption he's making. Jesus, as we know, did not write anything in the Bible. Other people wrote about Jesus, and they wrote about Jesus, depending on who you're reading or acknowledging, somewhere between 40 to 50 to even 80 years after he died. So these are not people writing things down the day he says them, but rather a corporate memory carried throughout decades, and then Jesus' words are recorded on paper, allegedly. And C.S. Lewis does not acknowledge the possibility that liar, lord, or lunatic aren't there, are not the only three options. Another option is Jesus' words weren't recorded correctly. And maybe Jesus didn't say all these things. Maybe he did say all the moral things and never claimed to be God, in which case he wouldn't be a lunatic, because he never said that. Somebody else attributed that to him later. Another possibility and not so far-fetched is that Jesus was speaking in metaphors. He certainly did this when he talked in parables. What about some of these other things when he talks about being the Son of Man or the Son of God? What if those are not meant to be taken as literal relationships, but metaphors for something else? So you have at least three other options besides C.S. Lewis's three. Sloppy thinking allows you to say, yeah, C.S. Lewis nailed it. You only have three choices. No, you don't only have three choices. Dig at it a little bit. How about sloppy thinking concerning prayer? This is one that I encountered again in high school and college, because people would say, God always answers your prayer. But of course, we know that's not true. Even sound fundamentalist Christians who really love God as I did could see that God didn't always answer prayers, not the way we wanted them to anyway. And so there was this phrase that people would use, God always answers your prayer, but the answer is yes, no, or wait. Now think about that for a second. If God's answer to your prayer is going to be either yes, no, or wait, how is that different from God not answering your prayer at all? It is exactly the same thing. You pray without any expectation of anything happening the way you want it to, because he might say no. He might say, well, not now, but later. And maybe you'll get what you pray for. But if that is how you interpret God always answers prayer, that's sloppy thinking. And that line works for people, by the way. It worked for me at the time. I thought, okay, that makes sense. God does always answer prayer, just may not be the way I think he's going to answer it, but that doesn't really prove God answers prayer at all. Sloppy thinking. Here's some other beliefs, and you may hold some of these. And before I go through all these, what I want to say is, if you hold these, that doesn't mean they're wrong, and it doesn't mean you're being illogical. But I do want to point out how people who hold them do practice sloppy thinking sometimes and encourage you not to. First of all, do you believe astrology works? The problem with astrology, and there are many, are, first of all, there's many different types of astrology. It doesn't acknowledge the changing positions of planets and stars over hundreds of thousands of years or tens of thousands. And the fact that different astrologers will come up with different readings for the same person. So maybe some of them are right and some of them are wrong, but there's just so much vagueness and so much waffling in the world of astrology. I'm not convinced it works, and it needs to be held to a very high standard by anyone who thinks it does. Don't accept the smoke and mirrors. Hold it to a high standard. How about magic? Some people enjoy casting spells. I've met people who cast spells. I don't think there's any real evidence that it works, however. It might be comforting to people. But if magic spells really worked in the same way that, say, medicine works, then you would have Hogwarts all over the place. You would have true colleges of magic where you could count on something working. A spell would really definitely work. If you have a headache and take Excedrin like I do, the headache goes away. It works. I demonstrate this on a regular basis because I've wrestled with headaches most of my life. If someone says they can do a magic spell to get rid of my headache, I'd say, great, show me. Does it work? Does it work continuously? You know, can I count on it to work tomorrow and a week from now? And if it did, I'm a believer. I'm sold. Sign me up. I want to go to Hogwarts. But if it doesn't, it's bogus in my mind. And then there's some moral aspects to magic. There are magic spells where you're trying to make somebody else do something. Why is that a moral thing to do? To make, especially things like love potions and spells to make someone be attracted to you. That'd be horrible to try to change somebody's mind through magic instead of them just coming to that on their own. How about the notion of God? Does God exist? Do you think that God cares about you? Do you think God cares that you believe God exists? Maybe God doesn't mind if you're not sure. Maybe God really doesn't care at all what you think about God. And if we want to propose that there's a God who really wants us to believe in God, perhaps we could get a truly impressive demonstration. And I've talked about this before. You know, you can do some truly impressive miracles just redoing the ones in the Bible, like stopping the earth from rotating. That'd be really amazing. Because if the earth just stopped spinning, everything else would keep going, and you just have, but not in the Bible. Everything stopped. No one got hurt. The sun just stayed there so they could fight a battle a lot longer and have more daylight. But man, if that happened today, people would be going, okay, how did that happen? Maybe this God thing is true. I would, because that just defies everything we know about science and physics and astronomy and everything else. But we don't get those. So why don't we demand that kind of proof? The list goes on, by the way. There's many, many things. I couldn't possibly list them all where people employ sloppy thinking. Reincarnation. You know, we were talking about this the other day, and somebody said, you know, the problem with reincarnation is, right, you know, right now we have about 8 billion people on the planet. But if you're constantly getting reincarnated, where were all those souls way back when there were like 1 billion people or 100,000 people? Where are all these souls coming from? I never thought of it that way. Heaven and hell, psychic healing, feng shui, speaking with the dead. I've talked about some of these in the past, and people will just sort of let the logic slip away because they want something to be true and they don't hold it to a high standard. And what I would say in closing, this whole emphasis on logic, on avoiding sloppy thinking, is this. I will keep an open mind on anything. I really will. I think it would be cool if there was a Bigfoot or a Loch Ness Monster or if friendly aliens landed on Earth. Friendly ones, I'll emphasize that. I would love that. That would be so awesome. And I read about Bigfoot growing up. I always thought that was so cool. I don't believe in Bigfoot. At this point, where everyone has a camera in their pocket and GPS systems and the forest is shrinking in the Pacific Northwest, I just don't think there's a Bigfoot. But I'll keep an open mind, but you gotta prove it. Gotta show me Bigfoot. I'm not gonna buy photos. No, show me Bigfoot. Show me the Loch Ness Monster. If aliens are constantly landing on our planet, well, let's have one on camera, on the news, speaking with us. You know, they could do that. So I'm just not buying. It's fun. I love reading about UFOs, but I'm just not buying it anymore. If you say you can heal people, if you're a faith healer, prove it. Go into a hospital outside of your domicile, outside of your parish, outside of your mega church, and you start healing the kids with leukemia. Impress me. Show me. Don't tell me. Show me. Prove it. Prove it. Even for the things you hold dear, the things that give you value, the path you're on, blind faith, I would argue, is not a virtue. It is not. It's shutting your brain off. It's letting other people take advantage of you. I would encourage you not to do it. Whatever is important to you, hold it to a high standard of evaluation and logic. And if it's worth having, it will hold up. If you don't do this, I again would argue that this is an abdication of responsibility, to yourself. You owe it to yourself, to the fact that you exist, to the fact that you have value, to not buy into things without critically evaluating them. So whatever you hold dear, put it to the test. Think. Be a smart player in the cosmic version of The Price is Right. Thank you.